Right, can you say your name and a little bit about yourself to start with?
Chris McGovern, Director of the History Curriculum Association, formerly Head of History at Lewis Priory Comprehensive School and King Edward VI Comprehensive School in Totnes. Currently Headmaster of St Anthony's Preparatory School in Hampstead, North London.
Lovely. Can you tell me about how your interest in history developed and why you decided to become a teacher?
Well, I suppose when you just talk about history, you're assuming history means narrative, and I suppose I'm interested in story. Today, it is contentious whether history is actually defined by being a narrative of the past, but my view of history has been and remains that it is a narrative, and it explains, I suppose, the world as it's come about today. It explains, I suppose, why people are as they are, the potential of people to do good and to do evil. So if you want to understand the world, you want to understand people, then you need to see what they've done, and therefore you need to study history. So I'm interested in people. You can't understand people without history. The absence of history is like an amnesia, you know, sort of it's an illness. So I'm interested in people. I'm interested in why things happen, and always was as a child. You know, I mean, I was inner city Birmingham, working class background, and I used to go to the library a lot and just absorb, just take the book, read the books. I love the books, love the stories, So, you know, as a child, I was fascinated in history. My parents were storytellers, and that's the background, really, I suppose.
Was school an important formative influence on your view of history?
Well, of course, when I eventually went to grammar school, and I suppose that was quite an achievement. I can't say the history teacher was anything special. But it was interesting. I mean, certainly in those days, undoubtedly, it was knowledge-based. And I remember at O-level we did the 19th, 20th century, political history mainly. And yes, I found it very interesting. And A-level we did the Stuarts. I think a lot of it was fairly dry stuff, I have to say, you know. But the narrative was still there. And a lot of the time, when you work on your own and you read, I suppose the school gave me some sort of stimulation. I don't think, to be honest, the school was massively influential in encouraging me along the path of history. It's just an intrinsically interesting subject. I can't say I was inspired by any one or two teachers.
But then you went to university and did history and then on to teach training.
Yeah, I did. I went to Keele University, which was a hotbed of left-wing Marxism and socialism back in the late 60s and early 70s. Next door to me was Tony Benn's son. It was an interesting time to be there. And I did 4 years there, got a first-class degree there. Then I went to Birmingham University and did my postgraduate teacher training, got a distinction for that. As far as the university goes, it was very stimulating. I mean, Keele was revolutionary in its approach because it had what was then called a foundation year course. They had a 4-year course, and the foundation year course was very broad, looked at all disciplines, and I did English as well as history, and I think it really was quite stimulating. I mean, obviously it varied. Even in those days, one of the best lecturers we had, I remember when he did his general course for the entire first year, it was very left-wing. I didn't know that at the time. It was all about the lives of the peasants and so forth in medieval England. I remember that. And I think at the time, well, why didn't he tell us about the kings and queens? I was a bit puzzled by that at the time. But I have to say, it was there was some very good teaching there. And it was quite stimulating, yes, I think it was. But when I went to Birmingham University, postgraduate certificate in education, I think the people who ran that course were themselves slightly confused about the direction they should take teacher training in, because that's 1974, and we were still in a world of O-levels, no national curriculum, and it was, I think it was quite difficult, because there was discussion in those days about taking history in new directions, and the school's council history project was just being trialled. But I think the lecturers at the university did not know where to take the subject. But I think they felt they ought to be taking it in terms of what was then described as a new history approach. which was still was just fairly new to me, I have to say. Though I actually was very interested in that approach, which was obviously more based, rather more on constructing the past for yourself rather than reading volumes about it.
That's interesting that you found that possibly quite an interesting route to children's understanding of history.
I think it was novel, you know. I mean, I've been to a grammar school which is fairly dry, and I think this approach was interesting. I left university teacher training qualified, didn't take up a teaching job. For a year I worked for Procter & Gamble in television advertising. I felt I'd had enough, quite frankly. I needed a break. I did a year out in Newcastle-on-Tyne, actually, which I loved, actually. It wasn't for me, but it was very interesting for me to do it. Came into teaching in North Yorkshire in a large comprehensive of 2,000 children. And interestingly, that school was one of the pilot schools for the Schools Council History Project.
Which school was it?
It was called Harrogate Granby High School.
Right.
And it was an amalgamation of a secondary modern and a grammar school. And, you know, 2,000 children, quite a challenge. Mm. And I actually found that approach really quite stimulating at that time and was quite enthusiastic about it. I mean, one's ideas are still forming, of course, and I felt looking at evidence and to some extent being encouraged to ask questions was a little bit new in some ways to what I've been used to. So I was quite interested and quite enthusiastic about it. And I was there from 4 years, I suppose. But even in that school, there was a division between there was a department which was split between half the department were not interested in new history and half were, and I was in both camps, because I taught the O-level, I taught the CSE, but the CSE I taught was a very traditional course, and the O-level was part of it, was a Schools Council project course. So it was an interesting place to start. Mm. I must say, in those days, I had no understanding, really, of where this whole debate was going to take me. And no feelings that I might one day be evicted from the state sector, which I was.
So how did you come to work at Priory School? Was that your next school?
No, I went from North Yorkshire to Devon. So I was promoted internally at Harrogate Granby High School. Then I was promoted again to head of history at King Edward VI. School and Community College, it is comprehensive school effectively in Devon, which is a long way to go from Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. Went there in 1980, and when I went there, actually, I, as far as my own views were concerned, I suppose I was quite, and always have been quite keen on choice, and I brought with me two Totnes Schools Council ideas, and I felt they were very interesting. It was still the time of O-level, remember, and what we did at Totnes was to run two O-levels. We had a traditional O-level, five essays, which I felt had value, and we had the Schools Council approach, and we let the children choose, and I felt that was quite a good way forward. But if people spoke to me then, I think they'd probably say I was quite enthusiastic about new history, which I was, but I still quite felt it quite important to have choice. But I didn't stay there that long, because 2.5 years I stayed there, it was highly successful, and a job came up in Lewes Priory Comprehensive. And it was a promotion. They were offering a high scale for the head of history, which is very unusual. So I applied and got that, and that was in 1982. So that's when I moved to Lewes. But when I moved to Lewes, I was still fairly enthusiastic about aspects of new history, and I had a divided department there where some people wanted to keep with a very traditional course. Myself and one other were much more open to new ideas. I was of the opinion that we should possibly have choices, as we had in Totnes, and there was, to some extent, there was quite a lot of internal conflict there. But I do listen to people, and I do listen to arguments, and I suppose that the great sort of turning point for me, the sort of road to Damascus moment, was when I saw the trial papers for GCSE. Mm. When was it? 86, I think, that sort of time. And by this time, things had settled down in the school. You know, my views were inclined towards, I would say, perhaps inclined more towards new history than traditional, but I was fairly open-minded because I taught a very traditional A-level course. And I must say, it was a very successful department. The department in Lewis was probably the most successful in the country in terms of results. But we also catered for a wide range of ability, CSC as well as O level, as well as A level. A lot of kids, well, a number of kids going on to Oxbridge, but also a number of children who were not able, doing well. Very successful department. It had sort of settled down in terms of, you know, my views were not entirely the same as my two members of my department. But then I saw the trial papers for GCSE, and I was gobsmacked. I really, for the first time, saw, I think, where history was going. And what I can still remember some of the trial questions, which were, these are questions about the Second World War, and they were asking questions such as, why, and this is, I quote this virtually, why didn't the Allies tell the Germans where they would be landing at D-Day? Why did they keep their plans as secret as possible? That was the standard of the question. This made the question very accessible, of course, to anybody doing it, because the exam was intended for all abilities. Mad questions. Other questions which were also thrown out as trial questions were empathy questions, about which there became a big argument. One of the empathy questions which I felt particularly strongly about was one which asked children to imagine that they were Palestinian terrorists and to explain why they blew up an Israeli passenger plane. But that was worrying, because that was quite that had happened, and it had been quite recent. It was very contentious. Putting this before children who are basically immature in their thinking, I thought was highly dangerous. But what was most worrying about all of that was that the mark scheme for empathy questions required, in order to get a high mark, it required children to show something called differentiated historical empathy, which meant that in a good answer on your GCSE paper, you had to show differing points of view. So as the Palestinian terrorist, you had to give the point of view of the Palestinian terrorist, and also the point of view, a recognition of the point of view of the people you were blowing up. Now, what do you do with a child who writes that in an essay? I'm a Palestinian terrorist, I'm going to blow up these people for these reasons, but I understand the point of view of the people I'm blowing up. Do you give them a grade A or send them to a psychiatrist? Because that's where we were, you know. And I knew when I read it, I said, look, this is awful. So I went back to my department and I said, look, we've got to do something about this. I mean, this is, and their view was, well, you know, we will support you because we agree. I mean, this is awful. And famously, what we decided to do, I mean, we were fairly bright people. My second department, Tony Freeman, his PhD in history, and Arthur Franklin, who was also in the department, he's an MA, and Derek Heppenstall was a fourth member. He stayed a little bit more on the sidelines. But what we decided to do, because we were so dissatisfied with the quality of these papers, was and it was generated simply by us, we decided that we would try and do something to get around the deficiencies of the GCSE exam, which we were going to teach.
Can I just ask you, when you first saw the trial papers, was that before you even started teaching the course in 1986?
Yeah, it was that they were preliminary to that.
Yes.
So the dating I've given you may be wrong. They came, I think, in the summer term. You have to have the trial papers before you teach the course.
Yes.
Yeah.
The
may have been. I think it was the summer term.
And that's from a particular board.
It was a Southern board, yeah. Southern, but I don't board. Think there was. I mean, it was a particular board. I don't think they were the criteria for GCSE were national criteria, and they were overseen. So it wasn't just, I don't think, the Southern board. I mean, it may have been a more extreme example, but I don't think it was. We really were concerned. I mean, we're concerned that we're going to be teaching this to our 14 and 15 year olds. They're not going to be well prepared.
You were doing Modern World course, were you?
Yeah. But they're not going to be well prepared for A-level. So we need to teach them some proper history. So we looked around for an alternative. But the government had cleverly closed every possibility, because the government has the Secretary of State has to approve exams, and his certificate goes on an exam to show that he's approved. At the moment, for example, here we are, 2009, the government doesn't allow state schools to sit the international GCSE. It's not an approved qualification. I think it's under Section 5 of one of the Education Acts. Anyway, we looked around, and what we'd found is that the government had closed every loophole. There were no alternatives. But then we came up with the idea, well, actually, there is an alternative, because in Scotland, they were moving along the GCSE path, but they were retaining their version of the O-level. The O grade exam.
As a choice for schools?
As a choice initially, yeah, which we felt actually was much more intelligent because they ran the two together. And so what we decided should be done was that we should double enter children, same period of history, but we would enter them for the GCSE on the modern world, and we'd enter them for the O grade, the Scottish O level.
When you first became concerned, were you aware that in other schools there were people doing Southern Board who were also worried about the assessment of GCSE?
Not especially, no. I don't think we were aware. We spoke to the board later, and it was explained to us that there was some concern. But if that concern existed, it wasn't expressed in any sort of public forum or any major public forum. Mm. So not one we came across. And it wasn't picked up in the media or the press, but where you would expect it to be picked up in. So we were rather solitary in this, I have to say. We weren't isolated. We were a very good department. We went to meetings and so forth. And this is quite early days.
I would have thought there might have been others who would have expressed the concern about preparation for A-level, because many schools would have that issue, wouldn't they?
Well, you're right, and in fact, I don't think they did to any great extent, and they didn't. And the reason, one of the reasons why they didn't, is that if you do so, you were going against the spirit of the age, and you, as it turned out, would be putting your livelihood in jeopardy. This sounds very sinister, doesn't it? Mm. But that became apparent later. You know, well, I will tell you what happened next, because this was the famous explosion. Mm. We thought that we would try to double enter children, but I was head of department, we couldn't just do this. So we wrote a letter to, I think it was to the headmaster, it may have been to the governors, but I think it was to the headmaster, but I'm not sure, I can't recall. Anyway, we wrote a letter requesting permission to double enter children. And that was discussed at a governor's meeting. And the governor's meeting took place on the night of the great hurricane in the southeast of England, ironically. And my goodness, a hurricane did blow, because there were two teacher representatives, teacher governors at that meeting, who were not well disposed to our point of view. They were very enthusiastic about GCSE, which they thought was much more accommodating. I mean, let's face it, the arguments for GCSE was that it accommodates everybody, you know. Well, we got a letter back from our representatives, and the letter reported what had been said in the meeting. And in the governor's meeting, it said that governors felt that we were guilty of insubordination, mutiny, which was a capital offence, and insubordination. And many governors, it said, felt it warranted sackings, and these were discussed in the presence of county officers.
That was as early as October 1987?
Yes, it was indeed, yeah. That letter became very important, because it showed what you were dealing with on the other side. Here was a reasonable request, and it was treated with an iron fist. They got it completely wrong, of course, because it was not correct to discuss sacking teachers in the presence of county officers. It meant, in the sense that in the months that followed, their hands were tied a little bit, because had they sacked us, it would have been seen as prejudicial, because they'd already discussed it at this meeting, and they'd acted incorrectly. They should not have been discussing sacking teachers. So it was very, very intimidating, you know, extremely intimidating. And we had a choice. We could have either caved in and said, my God, our livelihoods are at stake here, they're threatening to sack us, what are we going to do? Or we could fight.
But so during this time, you were conducting extra lessons for the children?
No, not initially. No, we had the letter back. And then we decided to fight. So what we decided to do was we would do these extra lessons, but we couldn't do them on school premises, obviously. That would have been, we had to accept the ruling of the headmaster. We weren't trying to be rebels in that sense. we were actually trying to stick up for our subject. So we knew we would do our best with the GCSE, but we couldn't teach Scottish O level on the school. But we did want to get the message out to the children, or to the parents of the children, that we would offer preparation for Scottish O level off school premises in our own time without charge, and we would enter them, which is what we did. And we hired a room in a college opposite the school. Well, this didn't go down very well, not least because there were the quite close connections between the college and the school. In fact, there was a deputy head at the school who was married to the principal of the college, so it was hardly a secret, you know. And we felt very aggrieved the way the tone of the attack on us, you know. And I suppose, in a sense, they handled it very badly, because we're not the sort of people who will just fall over. And we informed the local newspaper, the Brighton paper, Evening Argus, that we were running these lessons. And they reported it. And that was interesting, because then the school, the headmaster, sent out a letter to parents who were unaware. They don't read this paper, because you told them what was going on, effectively. And then it got into the national press, you know. And interesting, on one occasion, the Evening Argus journalist came to one of the lessons. He wanted to witness one of the lessons, and he turned up, and he sat with me and another and a colleague as we were waiting for the room to become free. And the principal of the college over the road, he came. He didn't know this person was a journalist, but he knew that the press had picked it up, and he came to me sitting there, and he had a real go at me, for this being in the press, and so I would never be allowed to use these rooms again, and how outrageous it all was. And after he'd had this outrageous attack, I felt, I said, "Can I introduce you to this journalist from the Evening Argus?" He was gobsmacked and ran away, basically. But I said to the journalist, "Look, this is, you can see here what we're up against." Anyway, so it got into the press. You know, I think we sort of knew. It was a very risky. This was incredibly risky, and it escalated from there. But interesting, one of the parents of one of the boys who was taking the Scottish O level was Robert Skidowski, who was a historian, professor of political economy at Warwick at the time, and eventually very prominent historian, eventually promoted to the House of Lords and a major thinker initially, well, eventually in the Conservative Party, but he wasn't particularly conservative then, and he took an interest in this, and he read through the background information about GCSE, and he came to the conclusion that we were absolutely right and this had to be challenged. And this was someone who was at that time regarded, I think, as being sort of more liberal left than being conservative, but his views changed. So we got his support, I didn't know Robert Skidowski particularly. I didn't know anybody else who was supporting us, you know. I didn't know who they were. But Tony Freeman, who was a colleague, he had been invited prior to any of this to meetings in the House of Lords, which were education meetings, and one of the people he'd met there was Baroness Cox, who had been appointed by Margaret Thatcher as a baroness, and who had been through difficult times in London higher education. And I was then invited to go to these meetings. Were sort of quite large forums of people, educational issues that raised them, and that's how she became involved, and she was very supportive. Now, she was in the Conservative Party, and she was Deputy Speaker of the House of Lords, and she proved to be very supportive indeed. But these were sort of fairly lone voices. But I have to say that the parents, obviously some of the parents in the school supported us, but the educational establishment in East Sussex didn't. I know, quite interesting, because a few years ago, two or three years ago now, I went to a meeting at the local public school, and I met the chairman of governors of this public school, who remembered me. He found me and he said, "I know who you are. We haven't met for 17 years, but I know who you are." And I actually had taught his daughter at one stage. He was now chairman of governors of a prominent independent school. He said, "I just want to say to you, well done." He said, "I've never known anybody in my life so vilified as you were at that time by everybody." And he was part of that educational establishment. So we were. That was the atmosphere was one which was really quite threatening and intimidating. Mm. And because we, and the more we decided to fight, the more intimidating it became.
Do you think there were other circumstances around the situation in Lewis Priory School, for instance, you know, the impending loss of the sixth form and reorganisations that were happening at that time that influenced this reaction?
My reaction?
No, the reaction of the authorities.
Well, it's interesting that, isn't it? Because they wanted to get rid of us, that was for sure. We were probably overconfident because I was confident. I knew we ran a superb history department. We had a great department. We were very successful. You know, we were very popular. We were very good. And of course, that's overconfidence, and it's stupid to be so overconfident. The school was going through a process of reorganisation, and what they did was to use the process of reorganisation to ensure that I was not employed any longer in the school, nor was Tony Freeman, my second in department, who were the two major figures in this. Arthur Franklin, a third member, was employed in the new college, and Derek, who was the fourth member, who hadn't played a part in this anyway, he was kept on. But Tony Freeman and myself were the two figures. Now I think we were pretty much the only ones who weren't re-employed in some role. Mm. We went through interview processes and we had to reapply for our jobs. And I applied for my job I applied for both head of history head of humanities in the school, and for the similar position in the college, the sixth form college that was going to be a tertiary college. I wasn't appointed to either. This caused quite a row. Not just from us. No, we didn't go around protesting about this particularly. There was a movement amongst the parents. I mean, there was graffiti appearing on the walls of Lewis. The children felt. I mean, children have quite a sense of justice and injustice. They're quite instinctive, and they knew this was not just. Anyway, it didn't help, but it didn't save us. But there was a big parents. There was the annual report to parents, which took place in the middle of all this dispute back in the mid to late 80s, the governors of the school had to report to parents on an annual basis, and they did so, and a group of parents attempted to use that opportunity to fight our case. But the governing body of the school made it very difficult because they discussed other things for a very long time, for hours in fact, and anyway, it was obvious that there was a parent group who supported us. But the governor certainly didn't. And you know, the chairman of governors at the time, who was she was called Delia Venables, and I think Delia Venables was a Liberal Democrat, and she was had a prominent position on the local council. She was quoted in the press as saying that it would create an impossible situation if they were to allow. I mean, she was the chairman of governors, but also prominent politician. It would create an impossible situation if the school was to allow pupils to sit the exams of a foreign country, which was always quite amusing, because then we then invoked the Act of Union 707, which guaranteed free trade between England and Scotland, and asked the government they never did anything about it, but actually she was talking rubbish. There was no reason at all why an English school shouldn't sit a Scottish exam, just as Scottish schools sit English exams. But it was pretty frantic actually, and pretty difficult at the time. But I mean, all this in its personal, obviously, and it's a long time ago. But I think the key issue here about bringing it back to history is that on the one hand there was a debate between new history and history or traditional history, but as important was the fact that you were not allowed to engage in debate about the pros and cons of the new history.
But you said you originally were quite favourable to the history. Was it particular aspects that you liked about new history and particular aspects about GCSE which you didn't think were faithful to that, or had exaggerated aspects of the new history in a bad way? Or what was it about GCSE?
Well, yeah, it's a bit like asking St Paul what happened on the road to Damascus, isn't it, really? Not quite like that. one of the things I objected to was that it was watered down. The GCSE was a water. I mean, there had been an O level before. When I was teaching Schools Council history, it was an O level, not a GCSE. And the GCSE was clearly a very watered down academically. And also, I felt it was dealing with material which I didn't think was suitable for assessment. I mean, empathy, which became a big issue, I have to say, and there were whole loads of questions linked to empathy. Some of them were not, I mean, I talked about the terrorist one, but some of them were not about terror. I mean, another actual question, I think, which appeared was to ask children to write a letter home from the trenches in the First World War to describe the condition. It seems pretty, you know, okay there. But the problem was with marking it. I mean, I'm not against obviously empathy is important, but to assess it in a history exam is probably impossible, because if you were to write, if you're on the Western Front, you write a letter home, and if you write a letter home and comment, as many soldiers would have done on the local brothel, you wouldn't get any marks. But if you write about this is that we are the British Army, this is what we think, and this is what we know what the Germans think on the other side, then you get your A star, you know, your A grade as it was in those days. It was hopeless. I mean, it was watered down history, and it was not history at all.
Has empathy not been as dominant a theme in the Schools Council history O level assessment?
I think it was still there. I mean, there was no doubt about that. And I remember talking to Dennis Shamilt, who was the author of all of this. He won't remember me talking to him, mind you, I have to say. This is about 1973 in the course in Brighton. He himself was very worried about all of this. What I'm saying is my views changed. You know, people, I think, you know, I think when you're, in the end, when the facts change, what do you do? Do you change the facts or change your opinion? I changed my opinion to quite a large extent, because what I saw was the way new history was going. I hadn't seen that very clearly, I don't think, when I was younger, earlier in my career. But I saw it very starkly. And I think, I mean, no doubt my views change. I mean, I'm not denying that. But I also think, because I was quite enthusiastic about new history initially, I came to it with an open mind. I was not someone who came into teaching and said, right, I'm some sort of diehard traditionalist, not at all. I was very open to new ideas and very enthusiastic about new ideas. Then you teach it and you go through it. And then you see how it develops and you say, no, this is going off the rails. Of course, there are aspects of so-called new history which are important. Of course, when you're teaching history, you hopefully will introduce children to some of the sources and some of the evidence which underpins some of the narrative. The problem is, you know, if you're teaching history and asking children to construct the past for themselves, and you've got, say, 10 to 15 hours to teach, what can I say, 1066 to 1500, well, you know, you can't do it, because you spend 2 or 3 hours doing Richard III, or maybe longer, and the Princes in the Tower, and there's no time for anything else. And the question then becomes, realistically, you know, what's more important to the children, that they get some sort of broad narrative, I'll say 1066 to 1500, or that they look at 2 or 3 things in detail. And by looking at them in detail, they are supposedly acquiring skills of evaluating evidence which underpins new history. But my view always has been that what defines history as a subject is knowledge of the past. There's nothing else which is unique about it. Now, skills of empathy are not confined to history. I mean, they fit in quite happily with English lessons, for example. Chronology fits in quite happily with narratives in English lessons. I did some research when I left Lewis Priory. They didn't re-employ me. I was retrained. I was sent on a retraining course as a primary teacher. I was sent into internal exile in Bognor Regis. You know, I compared East Sussex to East Germany as it was at the time, which I thought it was like that. And off I go to Bognor Regis.
Was that something suggested by the authority?
It was something suggested by me.
So you decided yourself to do
No, that? I had no choice. I mean, no. What was suggested by the authority was that I become a supply teacher. Oh. I go into a supply pool. And Tony Freeman, my colleague, did that and was eventually made redundant. So I could see the right... I mean, there was no question about it. There was no job. So, I'm interested in teaching. I'm interested in children. I'm interested in, you know, not just in my subject. I'm actually interested in engaging in teaching children something. And so I went off to Bognor. But I was put on teacher training... I went back to become a student teacher again after 13 years, and the rest of it. And whilst I was doing this, I was at a local school for about a term. I did some research, which I published in The Guardian. And what I did was to look at how you could best develop children's historical skills and empathy, how you could best teach the new history. Could you best teach the new history by looking at historical evidence, or would it be easier or more effective to teach the skills looking at fictional material? Hobbit, you know, Tolkien-style stuff. Well, what I found not surprising to me was that actually manipulating evidence and creating fiction was far more effective at teaching skills like chronology or empathy or bias than using real evidence. So I published this in The Guardian, and that caused another storm and completely blacklisted me from any school in East Sussex, I think. So there was I, you know, completely mad, you know. I mean, I suppose, you know, I have to accept the fact that I'm a combative sort of person. When I got married, my best man said my problem was I was born too late for World War II, and I suppose in a sense I've gone on like that, fighting these battles. So, you know, I did feel then I'd shown, and it had been published, and it was picked up by other newspapers and referred to, and you know, as far as East Sussex were concerned, I think I was finished. They did sort of come up with a possible school in Hastings at one stage, which was for all sorts of reasons I didn't think was going to be a great move for me at primary school, and it would have probably been temporary. So there it was, 1990, I think it was, I decided I looked for another job outside of the maintained sector, and I applied for a job as a teacher of a year three class at a prep school in Tunbridge Wells, Homewood House Prep School, in August. And it was so late in the day, you know, and it just happened that a teacher there had resigned at the last minute, or gone in August, gone to teach in Greece or something, and a job was there, and the headmaster there, called David Ives, who was a very good chap, he pointed me, he said, well, you know, he says, well, he knew I got a bit of a reputation, but he also, I think he knew I could teach. He said, look, you know, you come here, you're under a year's probation, or 2 years of probation, and I had been retrained, and I quite, you know, the retraining, I'd learned quite a lot in the retraining, so I went to Homewood House School, and worked my way up from, this is probably our baker coming here, so we'll just switch that off.
That you got, so okay. Come back on to record. When you were first involved in your, if you like, combat with the local authority, were you surprised about the sources of some of the support, Baroness Cox and, you know, other organisations which supported you?
Seen as being on the right. Look, I had no idea about these people. I mean, totally honestly, they didn't mean anything to me. I didn't know who they were. I had no idea whatsoever. I mean, it wasn't someone who was that, I mean, you know, not stupid, but I didn't know these individuals. I wasn't that politically aware. And the whole thing seemed, you know, I was just a bit daunting. Who is Baroness Cox? I've got no idea. What I wanted was someone to support her. I mean, we're very isolated. Mm-hmm. And even within the school, although I think amongst the staff at Lewis Priory, I actually think probably half of them, maybe more than half, were quietly supportive. They didn't dare say anything, you know. I mean, there was an atmosphere of threat and intimidation. I'll give you an example of that. Well, it's anecdotal, I suppose, but when I left that school, on the afternoon I left, I just walked out and drove out, and I went up to London, and there was a debate in the House of Lords on my case, and it was, I think, the 21st of July 1989. It's all in Hansard. It's a very important part of the story, because it was on a Friday afternoon when it was supposed to be, you know, quiet time in Parliament, but actually some prominent figures spoke. And anybody reading that debate, and I've shown it to friends of mine who are lawyers, they say the government's response, I mean, it was ineffectual and hopeless, and that if they were a barrister, they'd be struck off or something. I mean, but there was a debate on the situation, and I left the school. That was the end of story. But a little bit later, some of my colleagues at the school arranged for me to go to have a farewell do, as what happened, you know. They couldn't do it at the time because they were afraid. Anyway, about in October, three or four months later, they invited me to go to the pub and have a few drinks and go for a meal. As soon as the head teacher found out, he then arranged a staff do that night. And so, you know, and of course, a lot of them came to my farewell. And I think some of those teachers, I certainly know one who has since found his career, I think, somewhat blighted. It's anecdotal, but the sense of threat and intimidation was considerable. There were also members of staff at that school who were very much against us, very strongly against. And, you know, we got to the stage where we wanted support. And the Campaign for Real Education, which I'd never heard of, that was headed up by Nick Seaton. He was someone who, and is still battling today, I'd never heard of. I think he had fought a battle to save the grammar schools in York originally. And he and a man called Stuart Dukar, who was a historian, they were in touch. They were very supportive, and we were incredibly grateful to have support.
That campaign existed before.
Yeah, before we were around. Yeah. They were very supportive, and over the years, they've done an extraordinary job in highlighting some of the issues. They've been a lone voice there, so they supported us. But of course, they were seen. I mean, they were Baroness Cox, the Campaign for Real Education. They were seen as being on the right. But remember, we had a government which was conservative under Margaret Thatcher, and the problem I had was that in those days we made our argument. I was arguing the case publicly. That we needed to ensure that knowledge was a prominent part of any syllabus for the exam. And it really became a situation where if you promoted knowledge, you were seen as right-wing, which to me was incredible, because the whole Marxist view of history is actually based on factual knowledge. But what was really interesting in that was that possibly the most prominent left-wing historian in the country, a man called Raphael Samuel from Oxford, he was incredibly supportive, and in fact he dedicated a series of lectures to us, to myself and Tony Freeman, and I sat in the pub with Raphael Samuel, and he said, you believe in this and you're fighting for it, and that's what's important, and you love the subject. And Raphael Samuel and I, we did things, one or two, we did an Open University program together, and we were taking different points of view, but Raphael Samuel I have the greatest respect for, because he was someone who came from completely the other side, in a way, in the terms of the left-right thing, but he understood the issues at stake. He understood this was not simply about a left-right thing, it was about the importance of historical knowledge. And he also understood that, you know, there is a place for teaching about Nelson, as well as teaching about Victorian peasants or whatever, or pre-Victorian peasants and working-class people. You know, he understood that. He understood these there are defining moments in history which have to be taught to children. So, but being that much support, I have to say, the one thing I would say, the press tended to support us. Because I suppose, it's interesting, because the first newspaper really to do this in any sort of big way was The Independent. Peter Wilbey came here to my house, and he put the story out that we were doing the Scottish O-level, and then the other papers picked it up. And on the whole, I think 90% of the press coverage was pretty favourable. And I did various interviews, and I did television stuff and lots of radio stuff. The radio, I mean, that was less easy, I suppose. I mean, the thing was, at the time, I remember being interviewed once in The World at One, saying, well, you know, you're saying this, Mr. McGovern, but no one else is saying this. And I was saying, well, how can you possibly be right? I said, well, you know, it's a bit like, the GCSE is a bit like the tower blocks they built in the 60s. Great in theory, doesn't work in practice. But it's really quite a scary position to be in, because you are alone, and they're all, you know, people are ganged up against you within your own world. You know, I mean, it became a bit of a, I mean, I won't say a hate figure, that's not true. But I became certainly, people objected to me very strongly in the profession, and they didn't understand that what was really at the heart of this was the right to speak. And I accept the fact that there are different opinions. My view is that we were right, of course, in terms of history, but central to this was the fact that there should be debate, and it was under a Conservative government where this debate was stifled. And Kenneth Baker, who was originally it was Keith Joseph, and he actually we in the early days, back in the mid-80s, well, 88 was it, we with Baroness Cox's support, tried to amend the Education Bill, which went through the House of Lords. Is it 88?
1988.
Yeah, Kenneth Baker's grant. What we tried to insert into it was a clause saying that where a choice existed of examination, the choice should be made available to schools. And the Conservative Party didn't want it. The government didn't want it. Kenneth Baker didn't want it. And eventually it was voted down in the House of Lords. But what was extraordinary in that vote was that I remember sitting in the House of Lords watching the people file through to vote against it. A lot of Labour MPs came out of the bar, and and they didn't know what they were voting for. I remember Lord Blackburn, who's since gained certain notoriety, I remember Lord Blackburn walking by me and said, "Why are we voting with the government? Why are we supporting Margaret Thatcher?" As they walked by. But as Baroness Cox said, we had the quality of the vote. We did have support in there. And even Keith Joseph, who had been the Secretary of State, he supported it. To be fair to him, he was the architect of GCSE, and he put it through, but he said what had happened was a straight abuse of what he had intended, and he felt the idea of having a choice was right. I mean, at the end of the day, we weren't saying abolish GCSE, we were saying allow for choice, allow for O-level to continue to be offered. I mean, in fact, we had a huge row with the boards and with the government about whether it was legal to deny schools the right to offer O-level. And one of my colleagues, Arthur Franklin, he wrote to the Oxford board and said, you know, can we take the O-level if we want to? Is the O-level still in existence? And it was in existence because they were selling it abroad. And the Oxford board, they were incredibly snooty. The chairman of the Oxford board wrote back and said, basically, how dare you ask this question? So Arthur contacted Roy Jenkins, who was the Chancellor of the University, who told the Oxford board to answer properly. You know, and he knew, and they did in the end say, well, theoretically it is still available. You know, but there was a sort of, it's not a conspiracy because it's so universal, they wanted to close any door so there could not be any competition for GCSE. And that was because if GCSE had faced any competition, it would have collapsed, because everybody, I think, would recognise that unless the GCSE changed, the O-level, for all its deficiencies, was a more rigorous exam. And it is still seen as that today, the O-level being... The O-level today is marketed abroad by two exam boards as their gold standard exam. It is the Leaving Certificate in Singapore, and it is recognised throughout the world as the top qualification. The international GCSE, which is also available, is a lesser qualification, but it's still an improvement on the GCSE. But there's, at the moment in 2009, there's a little bit of competition creeping in, but the government still refuses to allow state schools even to take the IGCSE, let alone the O-level.
Why do you think it is that there's an insistence on having one exam for all abilities?
Well, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because there's a slightly sentimental view, I think, here, that if you have an O-level which caters for 20% of the population, this is highly unfair. And if you have a CSE which caters for another 40%, this is a second-rate exam for the middle band. And it is divisive. It is socially divisive. And that is correct. It is socially divisive. And I can see, therefore, how seductive it is to say have one exam for everybody. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in the real world, you have to allow able children to achieve their potential. And 20 years on now, we're in a world where we are competing with new vibrant economies in China, in India, in Southeast Asia, and they are separating their children on the basis of ability. We have to compete with them, and I think it's important that our able children succeed. And not just important for the able children, it's important that they succeed for the country so they can produce the wealth which will help those children who go into, should we say, less high-flown jobs, lower-paid jobs. I mean, at the end of the day, the country has to be successful. Parents, I mean, the thing, you know, we talked about the support, and I said there wasn't that much support, but there was, I think, instinctively parent support. You know,
did you get letters?
Yeah, I got a lot of letters. Yeah, a lot of letters, general public letters, you know. But yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted to do was to say, look, give me the freedom. We'll do. I would have been happy to do O level at Lewis Priory, and I know if we'd done O level, that school would have become better than, would be seen as being better than the schools around. I think now you might say, what does it mean better? That means you know you're elitist and all the rest of it. No, better at catering for more able children. And I think the CSE, which was the exam for middle band children, had a role. And if you got a top grade in CSE, it was equivalent to an O-level pass. And I think the lower ability children, probably at 14, should not be taking academic exams anyway. They should be on vocational courses. and their history education, you'd probably stop at 14. So if I had my way, I suppose you would suit the education to the child, but you must not prevent able children from being stretched, and nor must you deny all children access to knowledge of their, of the landmarks of their country and their continent. And that of course became a huge issue later, but so they were difficult times, you know. But I suppose it's in my nature to have fought those battles, so I'm not asking for sort of that sympathy on it. I mean, we fought the battle, we took the consequences, and it was tough. And Tony Freeman, my colleague, never worked again in any normal capacity, done part-time work, and I was never supposed to work again, I guess. So we're not here talking about sort of understanding gentle face of East Sussex County Council. Tony Freeman, who was an outstanding teacher, he's got a PhD in history, incredibly talented, never worked again in anything other than fill-in roles. Well, you know, that's disastrous, isn't it? For what it's worth, I never worked again in state schools, yet I would have, you know, I never dreamt of going into private sector. So now people pay large amounts of money for me to teach their children, and they are incredibly grateful. And the school I'm currently head teacher of, we have 7 applicants for each place. That's where we are now. You know. So I mean, I would have been very happy to have taught in the state sector, the maintained sector. I was driven out, and other people saw what happened, I think, and they didn't fancy the fight. They wouldn't.
Can I ask you about the History Curriculum Association? Was that an offshoot of the Campaign for Real
Education? No, it wasn't. It wasn't at all. It was something I convened. I convened it with Tony Freeman and Robert Skidelsky. We wanted to get together a group of historians, prominent historians, because we felt the argument could partly be won if we had, the best historical minds on our side. And so we pulled them together. And we launched this in the House of Lords, and it basically a group of very, very famous historians, and to basically give its opinion on curriculum changes. And Kenneth Baker at the time asked us to write a draft syllabus for GCSE in British history, which is what we did. And actually that draft syllabus, to some extent, influenced things, because we had in it, for example, a section on the making of the United Kingdom, which I think eventually became part of
Stage 3.
Yeah, it'd be sort of, they incorporate in certain ways. So the History Curriculum Association was important in representing the views of prominent historians, but not that they did very much. They underwrote, you know, people like Lord Blake, Lord Thomas of Swinnerton, Lord Runciman, Lord Alton. I mean, they're all dead now, of course. Lord Beloff. These were great historians, and they understood that the issue was concerned with historical knowledge. I'm not sure how far this got us, to be honest. I went to a debate once. I was invited to Ruskin College, I think possibly it came from Raphael Samuel, to be part of a debate, and I was alongside Professor Norman Stone, who was the professor of modern history at Oxford at the time, and you know, we were arguing in favour of traditional history, but the whole audience was incredibly antipathetic against us. And they would stand up and shout out, yes, but what about the racial element to that part of history? I remember Norman Stone replying, yeah, well, what was the racial element of Magna Carta? You know, there was a huge gulf between the profession and some of the leading historians in the country, and I think probably the parents. I mean, if you talk to parents, I think basically parents say, well, you know, history is an account of the past, and children do need to know something. But the profession had become it was as though the teachers owned the subject. And teachers don't own history. History belongs to the people. And it become the preserve of the profession, the guarded preserve. They will determine what's taught and how it's to be taught. Which led to the age of ignorance.
That brings us on to the national curriculum.
Yes.
1990. What was your view of it, you know, when you first heard about it, when it was first being introduced?
When it was first introduced, I didn't think it was very good, I have to say. The problem with it was, first of all, the chairman at the time, he was a benign chap, and he ran a country home, a castle, but I don't think he was on top of the issues at all. Appointed by Kenneth Baker as someone fairly neutral, I don't think it was very good. Kenneth Baker who put together that group, who wrote the national curriculum, he did not have an eye for detail. For example, one of the people he originally put on that group was Dennis Shamilt. Now, Dennis Shamilt was the architect of the Scores Cancer History Project. The one person Margaret Thatcher did not want on that group was Dennis Shamilt. That, I mean, you could not have got it more wrong. She eventually told him that he get him off. He wasn't even on it. He never got on it, in fact. He was never invited. But, you know, and she writes that in. That's in her autobiography. But I don't think necessarily the people there on that group were the people I would have chosen. And I don't think what they produced was workable. Because what they tried to do, they tried to satisfy Baker by having lots of history, knowledge, British history. And it's all there. You look at the original national curriculum, plenty of British history. But the assessment scheme was not knowledge-based. So whilst it says you've got to cover Anglo-Saxons, Vikings and Normans, that wasn't what was assessed. What was assessed was historical skills. So if you have a syllabus which is, seems to be knowledge-based, and an assessment system which is skills-based, it means that the knowledge won't get taught, because what's going to be assessed are the skills. So the knowledge will be, they will select little chunks of knowledge to fit in with the skills. So it was unworkable. Now, before that was published, I had a meeting with Margaret Thatcher, and she was alarmed. She says, I think she sent it back to, she sent this thing back to the Secretary of State on more than one occasion. And she said to me, you know, the First World War isn't there. I said, well, of course it's not there, because it's not important. Not in terms of new history, it doesn't matter what the content is, because what's important are the skills, and any content will allow you to teach the skills. Anyway, she got it put in as an option, First World War, and she called myself and Tony Freeman Renter down in the street to try to sort it out. Now, this was within a few days of it being published, and what were we supposed to do? We had this national curriculum in front of us, and we had to do something to ensure that it could be improved. Well, it was impossible. So what we did eventually was to make it unworkable. So what we did, I said you had a syllabus there which seemed to be content heavy, and then you had an assessment system which was skills based. But in the assessment system, as a heading to attainment one, we inserted the word knowledge. So we had as a heading knowledge and understanding of history. But actually, what you assessed wasn't about that, so it couldn't work. You had a heading that the assessment target was knowledge and understanding, but the actual details of the assessment scheme were not about that. It was about skills. Therefore, we inserted that word in, and therefore it wouldn't work. We knew it wouldn't work and had to be rewritten. So what we did that day for Margaret Thatcher was to make that thing unworkable, and therefore it'd have to be revised, which it was. And then I was called in to revise it.
In 1994?
1994, yeah. Well, that's when John Patton was the Secretary of State.
Yes. Can I ask you just about that meeting? Yeah. Was it just you and Tony Freeman and Margaret Thatcher and a civil servant or a secretary in the room?
No, we were invited to a meeting. We didn't know Margaret Thatcher was going to be there. Of people who were, well, it was part of the Centre for Policy Studies meeting, and it was a gathering. And Margaret Thatcher, I didn't know Margaret Thatcher was going to be there. I had no idea. But I was introduced to Margaret Thatcher, and we discussed history. And Brian Griffiths, who was the head of the policy unit, was also there, and he was very keen to get us round to Number 10 next morning, which came a bit of a shock to me, because at that stage I was still slightly in awe of government. I didn't understand how incompetent government is. I actually felt these people knew what they were doing, and I felt, Kenneth Baker, Secretary of State, is an immense figure. I actually thought he understood what he was doing, and of course they don't understand at all. So then we came into Number 10 and were given the national curriculum and put into a room, not with Margaret Thatcher, and sat down, right, sorted out. That wasn't the first visit to Number 10, because I was called back onto John Major as well, but in that particular case, yeah, and we changed it, and Brian Griffiths saw it, and that Margaret Thatcher saw it, I assume, and anyway, that's what was published. So the word knowledge suddenly appeared in it. They were interesting times. And I signed the book at Downing Street to prove I was there, in case in the future anybody should doubt it.
So what did you hope could be achieved by the Deering Review in 1994? That was the first major review of the national curriculum.
Well, yes, that was interesting, because that was preliminary to that. We had John Patton, the Secretary of State, who was an equivocal figure. He was someone who was not physically that well, but I think his heart was in the right place. And we had Baroness Blatch, who was the schools minister. And we had persuaded Emily Blatch and John Patton that history was a subject which needed to be revised. They understood that it wasn't working. We're not talking about the whole national curriculum there. So what happened was that Emily Blatch was very much on our side, I have to say, and she said she was horrified by what was going on. I mean, a lot of these things, I will say this, a lot of these matters are referred to in the book called The Corruption of the Curriculum, published in 2007 by Civitas, and which I contributed a chapter to, and I talk about some of these things. Anyway, Baroness Blatch was very much on side, and with the help of Robert Skidelsky, who was one of our people, part of the History Curriculum Association, we called a meeting of some people who had been involved in the debate. I don't know, 9 or 10 different people, prominent people who had been involved in the debate, not necessarily on our side. And we called it in Eastbourne, which I thought was rather nice, since it's very close to us here. Had a meeting in the hotel for 2 or 3 nights, and it's financed by the government. And we went through the National Curriculum for History, and we concluded, didn't agree on everything, but we concluded that it wasn't working, it had to be revised.
What date was that? When you had
it's
that?
All in that book. That would have been that's before the Deering Review. So we produced a paper which went back to John Patton, Emily Blatch, to say history isn't working, the knowledge component isn't secure, the assessment system is all skills-based, you need to revise it to ensure that knowledge is stronger.
You mean tested?
Not tested, that it is, that knowledge is taught.
Right.
And the factual information comes through, that you have a knowledge base. Because what was going on was that you had this list of events, some of which were optional, some of which were required. But you know, what you get the Spanish Armada, so teachers have to teach the Spanish Armada, but they also have to teach history through a whole range of perspectives. I mean, I think there are 24 of these perspectives. They include things such as social, gender, race, ethnicity, aesthetic. It was a legal requirement under the national curriculum to teach history through a series of perspectives, the light filters, right? So you get the Middle Ages or whatever, Saxons and Vikings, and you say, right, I'm going to do Alfred the Great, and I'm going to tell the story of Alfred the Great. That's your political history done. Now when you get on to William the Conqueror, you've done your political history, but you haven't done your gender history. So what happens is that you then teach the Norman Conquest as a gender issue, and you think that's quite impossible and what nonsense all this is. But in fact, it is quite possible to teach major political events from the point of view, for example, of the women who were left back in Normandy when the Normans invaded, or the wives of the Spanish sailors or the English sailors when they went off to fight the Spanish Armada. It's quite possible to teach Elizabeth I as an issue, or a social issue. So you look at how she dressed, what she wore, the sort of houses she lived in, because you have by law to teach history through social, aesthetic, racial, ethnic, gender perspectives. It is a requirement.
You're referring to the PESC formula, are you? The political,
social,
and cultural.
But it's much more than that. I mean, in the book, I list 20, currently in 2009, they've increased it to 26 different perspectives. Now, you
but
can't
that
do.
That wasn't originally the case, there were just these four.
No, it was limited. Well, it was more than four, actually. It was more. If you go back and look at it, I think you'll find there's more than four. They don't use the word perspective at all the times, I have to say.
No.
They use other words from the points of view of men and women and children, which is perspective, the child perspective. Anyway, I'm not sure how we got onto that, but one of the problems with teaching history under that original national curriculum was that there were these filters through which the subject had to be taught. And to obey the law, you had to teach through these different filters. And therefore, there's only so much material, and there are all these filters, therefore you have to do the gender perspective. And if you're teaching the Middle Ages, when are you going to do the gender perspective? You've got 10 hours to do it in.
Did you look at any of the textbooks that have been produced to see if that was reflected in the books and materials that were available?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, the textbooks got progressively worse. One of the books which I've, and it's come out actually slightly later, I mean, things have got worse, but one of the books which has been very prominent, a series of books produced by Longman, a very established publishers, and one particular book which is co-authored by a very prominent educationist from the University of Cambridge, someone who was involved with me in writing, in rewriting the national curriculum. She wrote this, co-authored this textbook for children on the 18th and 19th centuries, and it sidelines the main political issues and focuses on those perspectives and on social history. So sociology, for example, empathy. She's very concerned that children may not understand the point of view of the people who were victims of the British Empire. So what she says, what she has written in the book is, this is what Chief Crowfoot would say if he could come back from the dead. This is what this Aborigine chief would say if he could come back from the dead. So the undead are talking in this book. Now this might sound to you like total fantasy. It is all set out chapter and verse and quoted in the corruption of the curriculum. Now to have textbooks which are quoting as evidence things made up from people coming back from the dead is where you get to in the late 90s. That's what it led to. So we're looking at textbook. Textbooks were lacking in, look, the better textbooks were lacking in depth. They didn't have a lot of narrative in, they didn't have enough knowledge. The worse ones, but they were very popular, like these Longman books, offered a very distorted view of history. I mean, Wellington's view in that, Wellington's contribution to history in that book is that he opposed the Chartists. That's it. I mean, that, and there's lots of examples like that. And it's pretty awful. Now, that's a very popular textbook, and it has presumably been seen in classrooms by Ofsted inspectors. The inspectors have seen this book in operation and have said, what a good, and have presumably said, it's very good, and the lessons using it are very good lessons, because history invariably gets good Ofsted write-ups. But it gets good Ofsted write-ups because Ofsted are applying, they are seeing history as new history. And if you define history in terms of skills and concepts, then yes, indeed, these textbooks fit the bill very well. You know, I get people writing to me saying, you know, when we look at the Vikings and the Saxons, because the Vikings didn't leave any written evidence, not originally anyway, it's best to invent diaries of the Vikings to put alongside the accounts of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Now, this is fine if you want to teach new history. Inventing the evidence is fine. That's how you do it. But it's not really what I would call history. So, the textbooks, I did look at the textbooks, yes, and I wrote about the textbooks. Mm. And they were very poor. Interesting, in 2009, for the independent schools, new textbooks have now been written, which are much more content-based.
Oh, particularly for independent schools?
Yeah, for the Common Entrance Exam, Galore Publishing, which is the main publisher, the fact that they had asked me to write one, I never had the time to do it, but they've now produced textbooks which are much more narrative-based. So children in independent schools, then and now to some extent, are getting a much more narrative approach to history. I had some dealings with a black parents group in Lewisham a few years ago, and one of their leaders said to me, you know, the problem we have, he says, with this history syllabus is that our boys and girls in these schools, black kids, they're getting a non-stop diet of slavery and deprivation, social history. Why can't they have information about Nelson and Wellington, so they can go to Trafalgar Square and know who that bloke is on top of the column? Why can't they get what the Toffs at Eton are getting? That was his view, and I agree with him. And those were black parents living in a fairly poor area of London, saying, "Look, of course you've got to cover aspects of slavery and deprivation, but you also need to know the landmark events and figures, because in a way it's an access to." It's an access point into the higher echelons of society, you know. You're going to talk to people, you're going to see people, you're going to move around London. You need to know these things. Otherwise, you can't interact. You can't join the professional middle classes. You need to know. And so you're cutting people off because you don't have that map of the past. And that was when I was appointed to the working party to rewrite the national curriculum for history. That was central to my view, that we must nail down these landmarks. Now, can I just say that following the meeting in Eastbourne, we persuaded without difficulty John Patton and Emily Black that the history curriculum wasn't working. And we thought that was great.
So they attended that meeting?
No, they didn't. No. The report went to them. Yeah. We thought that was great, and we thought that would be all that was fine. You know, now we can go ahead and revise it. But they decided to revise the whole national curriculum, not just history. Which was in the end, it was so vast a project that we didn't get anywhere, because I ended up on a working party to revise the national curriculum for history. I wasn't a lone voice, because Professor Anthony O'Hare was also put onto that working party, and he was also seen as being on the right. I'm not on the right. Look, on the right. I've been in the trade union for 35 years. I've sat on the TUC. I'm even vilified on the British National Party website, I notice, as being a Marxist. So, but anyway, if you like knowledge, you're on the right. So Anthony O'Hare and myself were pro-knowledge, and we were seen as sort of, you know, we would sort it all out. And the decent people on the working party. But again, it ended up in tears. That working party, I wanted to nail down the main events. The other people, the majority on the working party, were far more interested in I think, the sociology of history, the perspectives and the skills. It was a problem. They didn't know much history either. Now, I'm a historian of sorts, but I'm not a professor of history. On that group, working party, there was only one historian, and he was a nice chap, but he was not a prominent historian. He might have been a professor or a lecturer of what had been a form of polytechnic. He wasn't a leading historian. He was a good chap, but basically they didn't know much history. And I'll give you an example of the lack of historical knowledge in that group. We had to go away in small party groups to do the details of the curriculum. One of the groups went away to determine what should be covered for the non-European aspects of that curriculum. So in the national curriculum, you have to teach non-European history. Nothing wrong with that, basically. So there's the choice, you know, four or five different topics. You choose one. Now, one of the topics they had chosen, put in the list, was the history of Benin. Benin, right, West Africa. And they came back and had the list of topics you could choose for the non-European history. And I sat there in this group, and I said, that's fine. You know, the civil servants there, I think, as well. And I said, now, which Benin do you mean? Now, there are two Benins. There's a country today called Benin, which is the former French colony of Dahomey. And there's Benin, which is a former kingdom in Nigeria. They didn't have any idea which country they meant. So if you look at the national curriculum now, today, in 2009, you'll find Benin there, but it doesn't say which one. And this was, you know, it's a flippant point in a way, isn't it? But it doesn't say which one. And I say that's why we had a problem, because I don't think the people actually writing the curriculum knew that much history. And that was a problem. And anyway, we didn't. John Patton, I had a meeting with John Patton before the whole thing was tied up. And he said to me, now you've tied down, haven't you, Nelson and Wellington and stuff. And Anthony O'Hare, I think he was with me, said, oh yes. I said, look, we haven't done anything of the sort. For a start, they're optional. In that national curriculum we wrote, the what seems to be the key events in British history are written in italics, which means they don't have to be taught. And Ron Deering and Chris Woodhead wrote to all the schools in the country to tell them, to assure them that what's in italics in the national curriculum did not have to be taught. So the vast majority of the key events did not have to be taught anyway. And there were some events which were in there, and you know, I think it was Anthony O'Hare said to me, well, look, you know, we've got the French Revolution, you've got the Napoleonic Wars, you've got the American Revolution, and my point was, no, we haven't. Now, anybody look, they look at the national curriculum and say, yes, we have. There it is, French Revolution. There it is, American Revolution. And I say, yes, but look at the words that come before it, the effect of the French Revolution. The effect of the American Revolution. And the effect of the French Revolution is not the same as the French Revolution. It's very different. So, you know, and I had raved about this in the meetings, and one occasion, one of the civil servants rang me back at school a day later, and he said, look, I know you were banging on about the American Revolution. You don't mean to say you think they should be taught the Boston Tea Party, do you? And I says, well, yes, I do think they should be taught the Boston Tea Party, because it's a central landmark. Not a mythology around it, but it's they have to talk that. Anyway, he didn't put it in. He said, well, we're going to give you Lord Shaftesbury's, because you said that should go in as well. We're going to put that in, because I'm not just about battles. And I said, Shaftesbury should go in, big, important. And that's the way it was conducted. And, I was unhappy with it. And, you know, I spoke to Robert Skidelsky and Tony Freeman before the final meeting of the working party and said, look, it's all going off the rails. We're not getting things in. What should I do? I said, should I just stop? Should I just sort of stop making a contribution? And they said, they persuaded me, no, you've really got to fight. to get in the landmarks. So I went to the final meet and I fought a big battle to insert the Glorious Revolution, for example, and some other key landmarks. And they were put in. I fought the battle and I won it. And so we've got a few things put in. And then, of course, later, people to attack me said, oh, yes, but we've got the Glorious Revolution. And then, anyway, I fought hard, but it was a hopeless battle because, ultimately, those landmarks, some of them, I've got a few put in, but the majority of landmarks were in italics, therefore they didn't have to be taught. The perspectives, those perspectives, the social, economic, aesthetic, racial, gender, cultural, political, no military, by the way, they were all firmly in place. And I felt, well, you know, these things haven't got to be taught. They're there in italics. There's not much which is actually written in. And you've got to look for the words, the effects of the French Revolution. So I was concerned, and I decided I better do something. And that's when Ron Deering rang me here at home, and he knew I was concerned. But Anthony O'Hare, who was the other person supposedly of my view, he wasn't. Anthony, who's not a teacher, he's a philosopher in the university. He didn't understand the detail, in my view. I think he'd been taken in by it all. Anyway, Deering rang here, and he asked to speak. And this, I'm a teacher in a classroom at home at Hesse Preparatory School. I had a half day off. Could we have a half day in Luke? We had work Saturday mornings. He rang here, and he said, could he speak to my diary secretary? Now, I don't have a secretary, and I certainly don't have a diary secretary. That's how much in touch. And Ron Deering. Ron Deering was a nice chap. Knew a lot about the post office. Knew very little about education, and even less about history. So he said, could I come in? Could he... was aware there was something in the winds here, and he was astute enough to know maybe he'd better get in. So I said yes, I'd go up to London to see him. Go into his office. Didn't know that he would have lined up alongside him Anthony O'Hare and Nick Tate. Nick Tate was the chairman of that group. Nick Tate eventually became headmaster of Winchester, and don't think it worked out too well for him. But anyway, he was those, and they were very aggressive to me, and I felt it was rather unfair because he hadn't told me who was going to be present at the meeting. I pointed out to Deering that I didn't think that term, the curriculum, would work. And he was adamant, and he was adamant later, that history, the history curriculum would work, and it would work because history can be... levels of attainment in history can be put onto 10 levels. I mean, I haven't mentioned this, but... What underpinned the entire national curriculum was what was called the TGAP model, the Task Group and Assessment and Testing, which had been put before the national curriculum started. It was decided that subjects could be put onto 10 levels, and Deering had taken this in, and he felt that history could be defined by 10 levels, that you could level 1, 2 up to 10 in terms of knowledge, understanding, and skills. I invited him. I said, look, I'll give you 10 levels, the 10 levels, and I'll mix them up and you put them back together again. He wasn't interested in doing that. There was no way history could be levelled into 10, and so he was into all of that. And history, he felt, he'd been told by civil servants, he didn't know very much, history could be levelled in 10 levels, could be assessed on 10 levels, which is all nonsense, and for each attainment target. And it was clear to me it wasn't going to get anywhere. So I came out of that meeting and thought, well, I've got to do something. And I knew the report was coming out within 3 weeks. And so I decided to write my minority report, which I wrote. And I published it, about 2 or 3 days before the national curriculum was published. And it caused a huge row, of course. I think anybody reading what I wrote in that minority report now would say, well, you were proved right, weren't you? Because the points I make in there have now been accepted. If you now hear what Gordon Brown's saying, let alone Michael Gove and the Conservative Party, there's a need for a return to narrative history. But at the time, because it caused a huge row, they tried to rubbish me and all the rest of it. They were exceedingly angry with me.
Why do you think Nick Tate and O'Hare were angry with you? Aggressive? Because,
well, they were... They felt I was upsetting the apple cart. They wanted to fix the curriculum. They'd been told to fix it. And they thought I was being difficult, but they didn't understand the detail. They didn't understand what was going on in schools. And they've got a job, which is to fix the curriculum. And they've got to get a consensus in the meeting. They want and about 10 people in the group. Therefore, they want 10 people to agree. They don't want 9 to agree and 1 to go out and say no, it's no good. I was pulled in, I suppose, to give my seal of approval to say yes, you know, even the government thinks this is okay. I wasn't just looking for argument for the argument's sake. I did think they got it wrong, and I think as events moved on, it was shown that they had got it wrong. Today, look, we're still lumbered with the same ideas. I mean, the current national curriculum, which was revised in the last year or so, is just the same. But there's a recognition there that it's not all that great. I think there's a much wider recognition that in history, narrative history, needs to be secured. Now, they were very angry with me over all that dispute, and it was very difficult. They saw me as some sort of some sort of troublemaker. I had form on this, because previous to all of this business of the national curriculum and GCSE, I can't remember when it was, sometime in the 90s, there had been plans to have assessment of key stage 1, 2 and 3. Never mind. And I was involved a little bit, not in writing the tests, but I was involved in that. When the tests were written and they'd gone through all their trials, they went to Downing Street, and Brian Griffiths, he got them to Robert Skidarsky and to me to look at. I did the review. I knew how to teach. By this time I was teaching year 3 children. I knew about this age group. And they were complete, in my view, complete rubbish. I won't go into all the details, but they were hopeless. And I think it was the fax through to Brian Griffiths, who was in Beijing at the time, to say that this was no good, these tests were no good. Now, Brian Griffiths, to be fair to him, relied on my judgment. He says, right, we'll get, you know, these things are coming out next week, get the people in to get the people who wrote them in to discuss them with you. So he called a meeting about 8 o'clock on a Friday night in Notting Hill. And that included Nick Tate, by the way, who went on to chair that meeting. I think he didn't like me very much. They called Nick Tate in, and there's other senior inspectors. And I sat here, I think I was with Tony Freeman, and they sat there. And I said, these tests are useless. And they were wild with anger about this. Anyway, we stopped them. They never saw the light of day. I don't think they ever forgave me for that. And I've still got the tests somewhere that I've done. They were hopeless. So there was a lot of resentment. And also, I made suggestions that one of the people who produced the tests was also involved in the publishing contract. And although this person said he had left the room when the contract was awarded, I felt this was very unsatisfactory. Anyway, the test never saw the light of day. So there was a lot of resentment amongst the inspectorate and amongst civil servants against me. And so you say, you know, that when I had this meeting after the national curriculum with Tate and with O'Hare, there was quite a lot of resentment. Then so that happened, and you know, we had this national curriculum, and I objected to it. You know, the numbers taken GCSE history have continued to decline. You know, it's described as a crisis subject. At O level, half the kids, 50% of those kids taken, 50%, I think it was, took 50% of the candidates took history, and then it's collapsed now. It's collapsed, and it's not collapsed. The Historical Association will argue that history, the new history, is more demanding and more difficult. But there's been research done by the University of London, I think, which suggests that children do not find it taxing enough. Now, it's quoted in my book again in the corruption of the curriculum. If people think that history is unpopular today with children because it's too difficult, they are fooling themselves. It is true that there are easy options out there at GCSE, we know that. But history is not unpopular because it's difficult. History is unpopular because it's not engaging children. And all this effort we put in with new history to engage children has failed because most children drop history at the earliest opportunity. So it hasn't worked. But then children love history when they watch it on television or they read books or they go to the cinema. I know this is a version of history, but history has never been more popular when David Starkey stands up. And he's someone who's very much of an opinion I share, I have to say. David Starkey stands up and they all listen. They want to know. You know. So it's not as though history itself is unpopular, but history GCSE is unpopular. And I think a lot of history in schools is unpopular. But that said, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really care what they do. I mean, I don't mind, as long as we've got freedom. I just want freedom to teach. I want schools to be free to teach the history they want. and therefore the parents can decide what they think is poor, what they think is good history. And I think most parents will say, yeah, we want our children to know about Julius Caesar, we want them to know about Alfred the Great and William the Conqueror and King John and so on. We want to know something about these people, you know, as children in every other country in the world do. You know, there's no question in France about saying we won't teach Napoleon.
So in that sense, history is really a means of transmitting a national heritage.
It's currently the only people who safeguard history in this country are the Blue Badge Guides and the Beef Eaters. They pass it on, but that's to foreign tourists. What history is binds a society together, and it shows you how we have acquired shared values. So it's incredibly important that history is a prominent part in the curriculum, to show how we've reached where we are today, to show that this society we've got has been built up organically over centuries, and that we share a common knowledge about this, you know, about the struggle for democracy is one example, you know, and not just British history, but that there are shared values. But if you don't know anything, you know, well then you're open to any fashion, you know. And then there's been a number of surveys, and BBC and others have done surveys of the public's knowledge of history, and particularly amongst younger generation, the knowledge is very poor. I mean, it's appalling. It's almost indescribably bad. With an older generation, it's better, but as time moves on, you know, the children who weren't taught narrative history at school, those people increase in number. I mean, you're going back now to the 60s, really, to children who were taught narrative history. Therefore those people are now older, and we have a whole perhaps 2-3 generations of people who never really got taught the narrative of Britain's past, and therefore they can feel a lack of identity. They can feel that they're not necessarily part of a society because they don't know about how the society has come about. Also, I think for people coming into the country, immigrants coming in, very important, and to some extent they do have classes now, very important that they understand how the country has been put together. That's if you want to keep the country with the same values it's had for, you know, for a long time. If you want to change society, then of course history gets in the way. So if you look at societies which have put a low value on history, and there are very few of those, but it would be societies that want to change. So, you know, under Mao, history was rewritten in China, so they wanted to create a new world. And to, you know, so I think in Pol Pot's Cambodia, year zero is when the revolution starts. So history is a very political subject, and it needs to be prominent. Now, whether or not there should be a national curriculum is another question. I don't, because I've seen how the national curriculum has worked out, I'm not really that much in favour of it. Margaret Thatcher originally didn't want a national curriculum for history. She wanted a basic curriculum for English, maths and science. That was it. I think parents would expect children to have a basic knowledge. At the moment, the national curriculum is hotchpotch for young. I mean, let's face it, most children drop history at 14. They get taught history in primary school from 5 to 11, and they jump around in time. They go from the Saxons, they go from the Egyptians to the Victorians to the Tudors and all over the place. In my school, they do it chronologically, but they do in the national curriculum. They do not have a coherent picture of the past. It's slightly better, perhaps in Key Stage 3, when there is an element of chronology there, but it is still a bit of a mishmash. So I don't think the situation at the moment is very good, and I think it's, if anything, worse than it was 20 years ago, because people have forgotten. A lot of people have forgotten what proper history teaching should be. I think they've forgotten that there is an alternative way of teaching history, which is the narrative. And children, of course, I'm teaching year two next week, and I also teach older children. But you know, children love stories, and what a lot of the educationists say is that, you know, you need to start with something which is very concrete. It's Piaget. You need to start with something which is very, very concrete and work from the known to the unknown. It all sounds very logical, but actually, children understand stories. If you ask them, if you tell them the story of Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, they understand the detail. And if you retell them the story, they will tell you if you've missed out any detail. So therefore, teachers shouldn't be worried that the children can't understand the ancient Egyptians or the ancient Greeks or the Saxons. They can understand the stories perfectly well. And you do not always need to go from the concrete to the less concrete. They can understand narrative. It also massively improves their English skills. And it also tells them about people, you know, and children are interested in that. And I can guarantee the children I teach the ancient Greeks to will be absolutely bowled over. They love it. They love the stories, you know, so the Greeks and the Persians, etc., they love it. And it improved their English skills. Now, we have a literacy strategy which has not been that successful, but one way in which history can help is for historical narrative to be inserted into the national literacy strategy, so that that will then support the history, but also improve children's sense of narrative. But I think we will get there. I think the way things are going now is that we will get back to a narrative history. We've gone back to phonics in reading. I mean, that was all cast aside. We've gone back to that. The Conservative Party have stressed time and time again, very recently, that children need to have a narrative understanding of the past. So I think we will get there. I think we need to teach storytelling to trainee teachers. You know, children love stories, and it underpins so many other things. And does, I mean, a lot of it, of course you could say, well, a lot of mythology, because, you know, Alfred the Great, a lot of it's mythology. Of course it is. It doesn't, so Robert the Bruce and the Spider, it's a lot of mythology. It doesn't matter. Those stories have helped to define the country, and they are important. Children know them. Then they can go and find out whether, in fact, Alfred really did burn the cakes. You know, that can come later, but they need to have the basic structure. And it works. I know it works, because I know what children like, and they like stories. And you like stories, and I like stories, and the whole world is built around stories. And that's it, you know, we need to get back that into history.
But you would say the stories and the critical thinking as well.
Yeah, of course you've got to have critical thinking. But you don't, with 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds, and they're very formative years, they can be critical in their thinking. And you can say, what would you have done on yourself? It's fine, you can do all of that. There's no problem, I've got no issues about that. But if you start saying, we're going to construct the story of Alfred, it's very difficult. You know. And in any case, but when you're in a school and you construct the past, you are selecting evidence. And the very process of selecting it means that you're probably going to be distorting it. So the job of an historian, a professional historian, is obviously to look at all the evidence. It's very difficult to do that. And so with children, I can select evidence to show, for example, that people who we would regard as being bad are good. Not a problem. I mean, in fact, the Schools Council History Project has done that with Osama bin Laden, the recent project they did. Effectively show that terrorism is okay. Well, you can do it because you can just select certain evidence. You know, and you can, there's no problem. You can show, but it's distorting. So you may be better off just, I mean, you could say, well, the story itself, that sort of, isn't all that. That's highly selected. It is, I agree, I accept that. But at least with the storybook, it's open for anybody to read. And there are elements of stories which are so well known that they're not that contentious, you know. And I think you know, the story of the Norman Conquest, the story of Alfred, the story of Claudius, the great stories, you know, the story of the French Revolution, a lot of it isn't that contested. The broad outline isn't that contested. And then I think when you get to sixth form, yes, I mean, you know, you can then start to maybe be looking at sources in more detail. But if you look at the GCSEs at the moment, the sources are highly manipulated, and they're not particularly demanding either. You don't need to know that much history to answer the questions. You just bring a general intelligence, comprehension skills. But the most important thing of all is that there should be freedom to debate those issues. And I'm quite prepared to accept that other people out there have totally different views from mine, and I don't agree with them. But I'll do it my way, and you do it your way. And that's it. And let the parents decide where they want to send their children to.
Yes, that deals with the sort of last question. But in a way, would it have been better not to have a national curriculum after all?
I don't think the national curriculum has been particularly successful. I can see why there should be a national curriculum for certain schools. I mean, maybe schools that are seen as failing when they are inspected, they should be a basic curriculum inserted into their schools. The problem with the national curriculum, it is a tyranny. And if you get it wrong, I mean, for example, the national curriculum effectively said don't teach phonics, or teach a mishmash of phonics and real books. It wasn't clear. It didn't say synthetic phonics. Now, that was a mistake. And 20 years on, the government decides we got it wrong. They did their research in Clackmannockshire, and the government decides, look, we got it wrong, synthetic phonics is the way to teach reading. They're now telling teachers in every primary school in the country, you must teach phonics. But the national curriculum made it effectively illegal to teach phonics. Well, not quite illegal. It says you've got to do the whole books. Real books, as they call it. Whole word recognition. Well, if you get it wrong in the national curriculum, you've got a disaster. Because, you know, you're making it illegal to do it right. So I think getting it wrong is the danger of the national curriculum. That's why I say maybe in English, maths and science, there should be a basic entitlement, as they call it. I think in history, it's difficult. People always have their differing views about this. And some people will say, you know, this is not relevant to my kids, I know that. I think that's why, in a sense, you need to denationalise the education system. I mean, I've been in the state centre, I was educated in the state centre, I know in the private centre, but I think ultimately you need to give schools more freedom and let the parents make a choice. I mean, you can say we teach narrative history here, or we teach this system here. This school might say we teach phonics, we teach real books, whole word recognition, and let the parents decide. But ultimately, of course, it's the market will decide, because they'll say the parents will want, I think the parents will want, I suspect, a more traditional style of education. But it's open, you know. I mean, I say this, I'm from a school which is probably the most bohemian school in the country. We have first name terms with children and staff. We have don't have any bells. We have a very strong rock band tradition. And, you know, I mean, I'm not some sort of right wing reactionary, but I'm in a school where we have pretty bright kids, and we do our, on the whole, we don't follow the national curriculum. It's not in all areas. I mean, we have to some extent, because it dictates the common entrance. But, you know, in history, we start with the dinosaurs, which is what the kids want.
Yeah. You know. I wanted to ask you question 10. When you concluded your minority report, you said, when measuring progress in history, knowledge has to be preeminent.
Yeah.
I wonder why. Could you explain what that really means?
Well, the one thing that makes history unique is that it is knowledge of the past. That's the only thing which is unique about history. As I said earlier, all the skills, which we talk about, empathy, chronology, detection of bias, they are not unique to history. They come in literature, for example, in particular. Causation, it comes in literature, comes in science. The only thing that makes history unique is that it is knowledge of the past. Therefore, if the unique quality of history is knowledge of the past, that's what should be central in it.
If you assess progress, how do you do that based on a knowledge criterion?
How do you assess progress? The more you know, and the more able you are to use information to construct a logical argument, the more progress you are making. Ultimately, what do historians want to do? They want to know more. That's why they write history books. They want to lift the lid. They want to know more. I know it's based on evidence. Of course, you've got to use evidence. But what makes history? What makes studying history different from studying, say, Lord of the Rings? In Lord of the Rings, you've got everything. You've got chronology. You've got causation. You've got continuity and change. It's all there. You might as well study Lord of the Rings as study history if you want to teach those new history concepts. I'm not against, by the way, teaching causation and continuity and chronology, all those things, but the best way to do it is with fiction. You can teach as a separate subject, teach new history and then teach history. What I think is important, that narrative of it, the narrative of this country's history, and to some extent of Europe and some other parts of the world, should be taught. Children should have the narrative base. By all means, children should understand causation and continuity. But what you don't do is say we're going to do that under the umbrella of history and we're going to manipulate it. We're going to teach history of medicine, for example, because that lends itself to the idea of progress, regression, progress. Because it seems to fit, we've got to do medicine because that fits into that. But it doesn't fit so well with other themes, you know. You mustn't manipulate the subject to fit in with the skills. You must teach the narrative. But by all means, you know, go ahead and, I mean, you know, when you're teaching English, Let's look at empathy, because that's what it is. I mean, and empathy is important. I understand empathy for understanding the past. Of course, it's important, but you can't really assess it. I don't think you can assess it. You cannot. I mean, you can say to a child or an 18-year-old, you know, explain why Othello was, in the end, duped by Iago. Can you enter Othello's mind on the basis of the text? Because it's all fiction anyway. You can do this. It's legitimate. But if you start saying, you know, how did Henry VIII think when he was doing this? It's difficult. You can't. How do you assess it? What was Henry VIII thinking about at this particular moment? It's quite difficult. difficult. impossible. But that doesn't mean empathy is not important. Empathy is very important. And it's part of, you know, part of an education. Mm. And literature, I think, is a history to some extent is. You just can't assess it. But in any case, ultimately, we've got limited time for history. Mm. And therefore, it's really a question of... I do ask children to empathise with the past. You know, it's a very interesting discussion. But ultimately, they need a narrative of the past. And there are, for all their arguments, there are well-accepted landmarks. And no one's going to particularly argue that, say, the Roman invasion wasn't an important landmark, and the arrival of the Saxons and Vikings and Normans, you know, the Reformation, King John, the Stuarts, you know. I mean, the Historical Association was saying recently, one of their spokesmen was saying recently, that in reality in the classrooms, you know, we do the Tudors, but not the Stuarts, because there's not enough time. Well, that's no good. And that's, I've quoted it in my book again, it's a leading figure, you know. In fact, they've been ditched, the Stuarts have been ditched. Well, you just can't do that. You know, because children do need to have that narrative. They do need to know about the Civil War. And it can be boring, of course, you know. We also know, how do you present it? One thing about the new history is that on the surface it seems easier to present in an attractive way. But I think that's why we need to focus quite a bit on teacher training and on storytelling, and indeed using lots of audiovisual resources to make it interesting. I mean, people are interested in story, but of course a teacher just standing up going through facts, it can be very dry. It's how it's told. And we need a television programme on, like Simon Sharma's series on the history of Britain, on for children, you know, the narrative. But children, you look at young children, they get spellbound by a good storyteller. No discipline problems. We want to know what happens next. And we watch EastEnders. Why do we watch EastEnders? Because we want to know what happens next. EastEnders is a narrative. You go and ask most people in the country who watch EastEnders, and I watched it occasionally, what happened in last week's episode, they'll tell you precisely what happened and why it happened and the causation and the continuity. And they will empathise with the characters.
Thanks very much.